The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to another episode of Land of the Rising Scrum here on Off the Ball. This is episode 14, and for those of you doing the maths now, we have six more teams to cover and just 4 weeks to get them all in. So this week we are going to double up. We're going to look at two countries, one from Pool C and one from Pool D. In a short while, former Fiji captain Atani Talai is going to join me on the line. But first though, we're going to focus on the USA this afternoon. World Cup regulars at this stage, they've played in all but one tournament, missing the 1995 tournament in South Africa. And despite being World Cup regulars though, they've only won three times before at the tournament. The last of those coming in 2011 against Russia. 4 years ago in 2015, they found themselves in a desperately tough pool alongside South Africa, Scotland, Japan and Samoa, and lost all four games, and it was quite disappointing as well, scored just five tries. But 2019 looks like being another tough pool. England, Argentina, France, Tonga for the USA. And this last World Cup cycle, it has seen some improvements. Last year's win against Scotland was the standout. And what we are going to focus on today is there is a strong Irish connection to the current group. Former Irish women's coach Greg McWilliams is there as an attack coach. And of the group that is just recently back from Fiji at the Pacific Nations Cup, three are Irish-born: John Quill, Dylan Fawcett and Paul Mullen. And there's also a fourth, Paddy Ryan, born in Chicago, but he did grow up in Cork and came through the Munster school system. One of those wild geese, though, is on the line right now to speak to me. 35 caps for the United States and hopefully heading to his second World Cup soon in the next few weeks. John Quill, live in New York. Thanks for speaking to us this afternoon.
No problem, Neil. How are things?
Not too bad. It looks absolutely fantastic where you are at the moment. You're New York-based. Looks like an absolutely beautiful day. I've been told you've been out enjoying yourself so far this afternoon.
Yeah, I just got a little bit of a surfing this morning just to get the body a bit more relaxed. It's back into training this week, so it's nice to have a bit of a change there.
Yeah, I was speaking to you earlier in the week and you were saying you're kind of, you have a few days off before you head back into camp in Colorado after the Pacific Nations Cup. Colorado is where you're going, the High Performance Center, but at the moment back home in New York, like, what are you doing at the moment getting ready? Is this a down week or are you kind of doing your own training?
Well, no, last week was a down week. We were actually lucky enough, we got 2 weeks off. We were into camp pretty early after the season, so we got 2 weeks off on the back of the PNC there. So last week, just chilled, got to see family, and this week, getting back into it, ramping it back up to head back to the mountains, back to the altitude, to more fitness testing and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, and Colorado, that's where is that where like the USA Rugby, their kind of high performance center, their main training center is based, where you go for all your camps?
It has been more recently, yeah. Since Gary Gold got involved, he kind of wanted to centralize it a little bit. We were bouncing around the country an awful lot. Travel here is crazy at the best of times. So he's kind of picked Colorado to be it, and he's went to the highest point of it in Colorado Springs to the Air Force Academy there. So that's where we're getting the bulk of our work done this summer.
And I suppose the altitude then, that just makes those training camps even tougher than they normally would be.
Yeah, the air is fairly rare up there, to be honest. Yeah, it's like breathing through a straw. But no, it's been standing to us though. Since we got out of the altitude to Fiji and stuff like that, it makes life an awful lot easier in terms of fitness.
And how long has that center been in place? You were saying you kind of bounced around the places. What kind of locations would you have been going to? And I suppose as well at the same time, they probably wouldn't have been rugby specific centers, would they?
No, absolutely not. I mean, in terms of camps for us, a lot of times you're just released from your club, you're in and you're playing that week. So you don't get much of a camp. It's only these long stretches of World Cup preps that we actually get together and see each other for more than 4 weeks at a time usually. So the last World Cup, we were in New York for a bit, we were in Philadelphia. We played an awful lot more games in the run up to the last one. Whereas this time we had our PNC and we just have Canada left before the World Cup. So it's a lot more fitness focused and kind of getting our cohesion rather than getting game time.
Yeah, you mentioned the PNC there. I'll chat a bit about that a little bit later on, but I want to start on your own background because born and raised in Cork in Youghal, would have been involved with Munster at underage level. Can you tell me your own story, kind of how, I suppose, even way back how you started out in rugby and then to the point of getting where you are now, ending up in the United States?
Sure, yeah. As you said, I Cork, born and raised down in Youghal. Would have played my youth rugby there. And then eventually moved up to Cork and played with Dolphin while I was in the Munster Sub Academy. I was in there for about 3 years. Unfortunately, didn't get a contract in 2012 when I finished my Sub Academy time. I was pretty competitive with the likes of Peter Romani, Tommy O'Donnell, and those boys. So fortunately, I missed out. And that's when I came over to the US first. I moved over to Boston in 2012 with my now wife. And I tried to get in just before the 2011 World Cup when Eddie was there, but just missed out on that. Just came in for a camp and was back out again. But in 2012, I got into the system. I got my first cap in November of that year. And since then, I've been bouncing from pillar to post. I was in London with London Welsh for a year. We got promoted to the Premiership. And then I was in Sacramento when they started the professional rugby over here, Denver for 2 years, and I've been in New York for the last year. It's been an eventful career. It kind of took a turn in 2012, but it turned out to be for the good, and it's been great.
And the initial move over to Boston in 2012, was part of that motivated by the fact that you knew there was the opportunity to play for the USA? We're not talking about residency rules or anything, because is it your mother, I think, was born in the States, so you were qualified to play, and as you hinted, you'd kind of looked at the possibility around 2010 or 11 of getting in with Eddie O'Sullivan. So when you were going over there in 2012, were you thinking this could be a long-term stay?
To be honest, no. It was actually because once I didn't get in 2011 and then not getting the contract in 2012, break from rugby, it's a very intense environment, being in those academies, especially trying to juggle it with a college. I just finished college in 2012 as well, so it was actually an opportunity to take a step back from it all and reassess, and I think I was in the country 2 days. And I was calling to a camp. So funny how it works out that way, and kind of haven't looked back since.
And when you were back in Ireland as well, as you said, played a bit of AIL rugby with Dolphin as well. There's a solid Dolphin core even around at the moment. Like, you know, you have the Scannell brothers, James Cronin as well. Would you have played in that kind of alongside any of them with Dolphin?
Yeah, James, he was same year as me, as well as Paddy Ryan, who's now an Eagle as well. It was a very competitive year. We had a quality team at the time. Disappointing to hear how Dolphin have gone since, with dropping a couple of divisions, because it's a great club. But Dave O'Callaghan, who's just after moving to Biarritz, who's a good friend of mine, would have been the same year as well. So there's definitely a lot of contacts around.
When you did finish up with Munster in the academy, was there a determination to kind of keep your rugby journey going? Because as you said, you've been all around the place, obviously going over to the States, then back over to playing a bit with London Irish, London Welsh as well, Sacramento, all over the United States. Like, you seem like you're open to any adventure possible.
Yeah, it was that, to be honest, because for a while, just before we came over to Sacramento, I'd been bouncing around, as you said, to a few different clubs in the UK. And then the opportunity to come over here came up, and kind of my missus turned to me. She's like, well, I could do the US for a little while. I've been chasing you for a bit. Now you can kind of go where I want to go. So it worked out that we could come here and see a little bit of this lifestyle, which has been fantastic. I'm not sure which point it was, but it came to a point where it was like, all right, it's time to start using rugby to benefit me rather than it kind of using me a little bit, which it can do for a lot of guys. So, I was lucky enough that I had the passport and was able to come over here.
Would you have been over and back a lot to the States when you were younger as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my mom would have been visiting. My mom's side of the family are on the East Coast in Philadelphia and New Jersey and stuff. She has five brothers and a sister. So a lot of aunts and uncles I've been able to see a lot more of this season, which I hadn't been able to see in a long time. So that was nice.
On the international front, I mentioned 2015 in the intro there and how it was quite a disappointing World Cup for the USA. You actually retired after that. Such was the frustration with the way things were going and the way they seemed to be going down the line. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, there was a lot of frustration because we had a quality squad and we didn't perform to the quality of that squad, which is the most frustrating thing. There was changes in staff after the World Cup, which was what kind of they reached out to me only about a year out once I retired. I kind of just said I wanted to kind of do the club thing and not have to travel with the US for a little while just because of those frustrations. But I mean, it's night and day now. The standard of coaching, the professionalism, it feels like it was 10 years ago rather than just 3.5. There was a lot of frustrations around it and then the results. So that's the plan going into this one. Yeah.
And what was it that brought you back? You said that kind of the plans had changed, the long-term plans had changed with the way the coaching went. Could you see it immediately that, you know, this actually was going to be a new dawn?
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually playing with Sacramento and the boys were in town. They had a game in Sacramento and John Mitchell at the time asked me just to come in and help out a little bit for the week that they were there. And I could see it was a very, very different to how I remembered it. So in the end, it was an easy decision to get back involved. John did great work for us and kind of made us a step in the right direction. And Gary's picked it up from there and really kicked on from it.
And what has changed? Like, you know, what have you done on the pitch even to the point where last year you were able to go out and beat Scotland, for example?
I feel like the biggest thing for us is we're training smarter. We're not on the pitch for the sake of being on the pitch. We're listening to guys' bodies. We're using GPS smarter. We've Hugh Bevan in now as strength and conditioning coach, and he's a wealth of experience and knowledge that we're really using to our benefit so that we're fitter, we feel ourselves one of the fittest teams that we come up against. We played against Japan a couple of weeks ago and they're known for their high intensity and their fitness, and we were able to stand up to that for the most part, fitness-wise at least. Yeah, it's those things, and then the management side of it. They're looking after our hotels are a little bit better and stuff like that. Guys are actually getting paid a little bit more, stuff like that. Whereas before it was kind of, this is what we've done and this is what we always do kind of thing. We're not taking that for granted. You just change and improve and tour to tour.
As I said, there are a lot of Irish guys in the squad. I'm going to get to those guys in a minute because it's a nice thing to be able to talk about having so many Irish-born players, you know, expanding their horizons and, you know, taking advantage of Irish or American relatives and stuff to go and chase their dreams of rugby. But in terms of the actual American-born players, like, where are these players coming from? What are their backgrounds? And, you know, when are they getting into rugby? What kind of a rugby culture is there in the States at the moment? And like, is it a growing sport, or is it still just essentially the guys who kind of aren't really making an American football? They might pick it up in college or something like that. Where are the rugby players in America coming from?
They're starting in high schools now more often than not. There's different pockets around the country where they're little hotbeds for rugby. You'd be surprised. You go to the likes of Seattle, parts of Texas, around California, especially up towards Sacramento and stuff like that, where rugby is very, very popular and kids are getting into it young. When I was in Colorado, they have camps for kids and they're out there every Tuesday and Thursday evening throughout the summer, just running around after a ball. And it's great to see, whereas when I came over first in 2012, it was just, as you said, all the guys that didn't make it in football still want to hit somebody. So they get together and some patch of grass somewhere and hash it out. But no, it's definitely growing. As I said, it's coming into the schools younger and younger. College programs now are very strong and are hunting talent from the high schools. One of our own, Greg McWilliams, is a head coach, director of rugby at Yale University, and he'll tell you himself that the standard of player that he's getting in there every year is growing and growing. So it's the scholarship starting to go for him, and that's what Americans want more than anything else, is once they hear scholarship next to a sport, they throw everything into it.
Yeah, that's definitely a massive thing as well. But unlike guys that might make it in the NFL, are they actually tapping into that market enough? Because it's this time of the year where over the next couple of weeks, there are going to be hundreds and hundreds of guys cut from NFL training rosters, and all of a sudden they're going to be out of a job. And, you know, here's this sport on the other side where they could be taken in and, you know, their game refined. Maybe, you know, the tackle technique changes a little bit, but like you have these ready-tuned athletes to kind of take advantage of. Is it worth looking into some of these guys more, or do you really have to kind of get them in a bit younger?
Well, I mean, the ones that are successful in rugby have been introduced, but even on a smaller scale in the off season, in the football off season, they still want to get a little bit of contact, or they want the conditioning. So they, in high school or in college, even if they're not in these big programs, they do have some idea of what rugby is, which makes it an awful lot easier to convert them. Even one of our, Ben Landry, who's a second row for the Eagles now, he was involved with the Seahawks and the Packers for a while, and he came back to rugby, Hayden Smith at the last World Cup. So there are guys that are able to go between. There are a lot of very talented athletes that if you could introduce them even in a small way young, and then if they didn't make it, they could definitely make the transition then in certain positions. Obviously, ball handling and stuff like that, they're not going to be out halves or anything like that. But
they need to learn how to tackle as well. They have a unique way of doing it. It's just running into players essentially is what they're doing.
It is. Yeah, I mean, geez, they hit her. Like in the MLR now, they have a few of these guys that have converted, and bloody hell, when they hit you, it hurts. I haven't experienced anything like the way they, like, yes, they might probably pick up about 10 concussions a season, but when you need to be aware of these kind of guys, because they're big guys and they just throw themselves at you.
Of the Irish guys then as well in the squad, like you're one of four, Dylan Fawcett, AJ McGinty, who everyone would know very well from his days in Connacht, Paul Mullen, and also Paddy Ryan as well, who you mentioned is a Dolphin club mate of yours, though he was actually born in the United States, I think, and
Chicago.
Yeah, in Chicago, and then grew up in Cork as well. But how fantastic is it to have that kind of core players over there? And I know, is it Dylan as well, is a teammate of yours in New York as well?
Yeah. No, it's brilliant. It's a little bit of a running joke, call us the Irish Mafia. it's great to have them lads, and it's just because I haven't been home very much over the last 4 years, so just to have that piece of Ireland with you, it's a different type of crack that you'd have with other lads, and it's just not to have obviously Greg McWilliams as well. He comes in and out of the Mafia, but we need him because he's got high ranking in the team. So, it's good. It's good to have these lads, and they're definitely performing. So I'm sure they'll be around for the World Cup.
Now, your Cork accent doesn't seem to have disappeared too much. Does the Americanism kind of just get ramped up a little bit when you're around all the other lads?
It does. I think I have to slow my talking down a little bit. My missus takes the piss out of me a bit for it, because her accent hasn't gone anywhere. Definitely around some of the American lads, I have to slow down because they have no idea what I'm saying half the time, to be honest. They're just kind of nodding some more, I think. Sorry, go on.
On the pitch, just gone, I was going to bring it on. Pacific Nations Cup just finished up. You were over in Fiji, beaten by the eventual winners, Japan. Two wins out of three. seemed like it went decent enough, just kind of just quite weren't up to the level of Japan in the end.
Yeah, we rotated quite a bit as well, so we didn't have quite the cohesion we hoped to have, especially coming up against a team like Japan. But yeah, it wasn't a bad run out though. We learned a few things about ourselves and kind of the standard where we need to be at if we expect to see some results this World Cup. But two out of three isn't bad. Samoa, a strong team. And Canada, we put a good score on them. So we're going in the right direction, and hopefully we can get a couple of guys that are still dealing with some injuries back into the squad now in the next couple of weeks, and have a full team out there for Japan and put in a performance as the against Canada to put in a performance. That'll be the main thing, kind of send us over then.
What are the thoughts, World Cup wise? Then I imagine Tonga is the one you're targeting, but before you even get to that, you have to play in order. You have to take on, where is it, like England, Argentina, and then France, all before you go up against Tonga. So, like, your best chance of winning a game is coming after the three toughest games you could probably play.
Yeah, well, we can see the same thing for them. So, I mean, yeah, pretty much couldn't pick a worse pool. But, I mean, it's an opportunity to do something that hasn't been done before by a US team, and that's exciting for us. We've made a few landmarks on our way to this World Cup since the last, and we want to continue to do that. We see some opportunities, albeit small, against France, England, Argentina. So we're not going to roll over in those games. We're definitely going to give it everything we have, and we're not going to save anything for that Tongan game. So yeah, we also have probably I think it's the longest travel and shortest turnaround of any team in the tournament, so we have to deal with that as well, which isn't easy, but again, just another obstacle we're looking forward to the challenge of.
Mm-hmm. And like, it is just an incredibly tough run, England, Argentina and France. In those particular games, like, no one essentially is expecting you to win any of those. And I remember earlier on in this, and I was speaking to Jack Berger when we were discussing Namibia several weeks ago, and he was saying that when he was going into games, when Namibia were going into games, when everyone's expecting them, you know, against the All Blacks, against Australia at World Cups, when everyone is expecting you to be beaten and beaten heavily, do you just kind of have to have the mindset of, you know, you go out, you do the things you worked on, you see what happens, and play for yourself as much as anyone else?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a different challenge than most teams are preparing themselves for this World Cup. But, I mean, we had this, it would have been the same chat before the last one. We just didn't do what we talked about doing and didn't have the game plan for it as well. Whereas this time round, we've no excuse. We've been prepared properly, and guys have bought into it. We have a quality squad. So if we stick to what we do best, who knows? We just have to hang in there. And the thing about games against us is if we're in it at halftime or just after halftime, it puts an awful lot of pressure on those bigger teams to be like, hang on here, we're expected to put a huge score here, and we're not doing it right now. So that's what happened last summer against Scotland, and we hope to kind of recreate that a little bit.
For those who listen here who might know too much about the US team, like, what are the strengths? I don't want you to give away the state secrets now, and because, you know, you're going to have to go out and beat England for us. Everyone wants to see that happen. But like, what are the areas of strength for the United States at the moment?
Traditionally, a very aggressive team. We've got some big boys.
Big ball carriers. Big ball
that
carriers.
Big ball carriers. So, yeah, that would be traditionally what we're about. And that hasn't changed. Just with that, we're just trying to marry with a bit of structure and a decent kicking game. So that's what we're about. It's fairly simple rugby, but if we do it well, we can get some change from it.
And quick word then, after the World Cup, back to Major League Rugby, Rugby United New York. The Major League Rugby still in its infancy. Is it the first proper season done and dusted? How has that gone off? What's it been like? How has it been received?
Very well, which is the first season for New York. It's the second season for MLR. It's really like even the standard from year one to year two was skyrocketed. Teams are already starting to sign some pretty big names just here in New York. Matthew Bastro, yeah, and Ben Foden and guys like that around the country. So it is, and certain teams have really started to get some proper crowds out. So hopefully it can keep growing, and it only means good team for us as a national team.
And is it a fully professional league?
Yeah, some guys. There's a bunch of, I say, from year one to year two, the part-timers shrunk, and I think it'll continue to shrink in the next few years. But there's a bunch of guys that still work in the city and then are training themselves in the gym and a couple of nights a week then with us. But the majority, I'd say 18 guys are full-time, and they make up squad for part-timers.
All right, John, we'll leave it there. So the line is starting to drop off again. Thanks a million for speaking to us on Off the Ball, and the very best of luck at the World Cup.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Yes, that was USA flanker John Quill speaking to us on Land of the Rising Scrum. A reminder, if you want to catch up on any of our previous episodes, you can do so by heading to offtheball.com/podcast or check us out on the Go Loud app. And you can also watch us back on YouTube as well, youtube.com/offtheball. And a reminder, all of our rugby coverage is brought to you by Vodafone, team of us, everyone in. Now, I told you we were doubling up today, and we're looking right across the Pacific Ocean now to Fiji, I think everyone's favourite second team at a Rugby World Cup, in Pool D this time around, alongside familiar opponents in Australia, Wales and Uruguay, all of whom they faced in 2015, and also Georgia as well. So joining me at the moment to chat about the Fijians, I have former Fiji captain Netani Talai, a veteran of 33 caps and 3 World Cups. Netani, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
As I was saying there in the pool stages, feels like deja vu looking at Pool D, because you played in 2015, 3 of those 4 opponents lined up to place Fiji again this year, Australia, Wales and Uruguay as well.
Yeah, well, it's a tough pool again. Well, I'm sure everyone's assuming it's the pool of death again. You know, you have Australia who's top favourite, then you have Wales who's coming in at second favourite, then apparently you have Georgia who's above Fiji at the moment for some reason. But, you know, Fiji is always unpredictable at stages. So hopefully the boys do, you know, show up during the pool stages.
As you mentioned there, Fiji, unpredictable, I think, is the word you used there. I think it's a fair way of describing them, because the common theme, as we always get with Fiji, win, lose or draw, is that you're always going to be entertained. You're always going to get that wonderful skill, the huge tackling. You were more of a power man, I think, than throwing the ball around from what I would have seen you for the likes of Edinburgh when you were playing in the Pro 12. What is it about the sport of rugby, though, and the Fijian people that just breeds this love for the game, this love of just running rugby, of throwing the ball around and essentially just going out there, smile on the face and enjoying yourself?
I think, you know, it takes us back to the roots from childhood. Like, most of these boys, they grew up just by throwing ever whatever they can pick up off the floor. You know, you're talking about a rugby ball. You're talking about empty cans. You're talking about empty juice bottles. You're talking about coconut, old coconut that's fallen from the tree. You know, and it's whatever they can play with makes them happy. And this is where the offloading comes in. You know, boys just love to throw the ball in any direction they can. You know, overhead, under the legs. But you know, I think that's what people want to watch, is the offloading and the women rugby. But with the modern rugby, you know, they have to take into consideration as well, you know, the breakdown, the scrums, the lineouts is an effective way of playing rugby nowadays. So hopefully, you know, the boys implement that into their game rather than just trying to run teams down for 80 minutes, which doesn't really happen nowadays. Because like nowadays, all teams are, you know, they're up for 80 minutes rugby, especially like running rugby.
In a completely hypothetical situation, if Fiji, after a World Cup or coming into this World Cup, were to get a new head coach and he decided that he was going to throw the playbook out of the window and all this running rugby would stop and the carefree attitude, and it was going to be a real strict game plan, a lot of discipline to it. How do you think, you know, and we'll say the results came with it, if they started to win consistently, how do you think that would be received in Fiji? Would they kind of, are they happier to just kind of enjoy the game and make it a spectacle without actually winning? Or, you know, if they were actually winning games, would they be happy if they were doing it in a boring way?
To a certain extent, to be honest. I think back at home, you know, spectators and fans are passionate about just rugby itself. And most people back at home don't just Fiji. They support other nations as well because, you know, they have families living abroad as well. So with Fiji winning, no matter how ever they win, even if it's by 3 points, it is still a win for everyone at home and everyone celebrates because it's a win. As much as they want to watch Fiji play the flair, the speed, the offloading, end of the day, Fijians want to see a win, no matter how it's done, you know, through a conversion or a drop goal. You know, they just want to see, it puts a smile across their faces just for a small island nation winning the game. And especially like if they are able to topple the two big teams like Wales and Australia.
Tell me about growing up in Fiji and kind of the role the rugby plays in your country. Because as you were saying there, you know, kids in Fiji, they're picking up whatever they can play with, you know, whether it's a coconut or a water bottle or an empty can of Coca-Cola or something like that. But, you know, when you are doing that, you know, when you're playing as a young kid, is like, are there any other sports that are being played to a great extent in Fiji? Rugby is the one we all associate with the country.
Not really, because, you know, you have tennis, you have soccer, which is football as well, but you know, most kids nowadays just gradually convert into rugby, no matter what age, what race, you know, because it's a big sport at the moment, because World Cup is a hype at the moment. Growing up, you know, is, yeah, you know, for instance, myself, I grew up as a middle distance runner rather than a rugby player, because, you know, I was just brought into that sport. But because all my mates played rugby, I kind of like wanted to be involved. I wanted to be accepted into rugby. So I had to choose rugby over running. So it's just a normal thing for a kid coming through, you know, the islands, just picking up a rugby ball, playing rugby rather than any other sport, because, you know, we don't have the facilities for any other sport except swimming. But, you know, an open field, you find a small patch of land, you'll see kids playing rugby there, because all they need is whatever they can get their hands on, a can of Coke, a bottle to play, rather, because we don't have the facilities, really.
How far do you think Fiji could go if they actually did have the facilities, if they were to be helped out by, you know, World Rugby, and not just Fiji as well, we're talking Tonga, and, you know, I spoke to a friend of yours, Dan Leo, as well, when we were talking about Samoa, and how the likes of Fiji, Tonga and Samoa tend to be left behind a lot. Like, how far could these countries go if they were given the right structures in place and helped along the way a little bit more?
You know, massively. It will make a massive difference, to be honest. You know, similar to like 2006, there was a massive funding from the World Rugby, which, you know, the team didn't see any single penny, to be honest. Don't know where the money disappeared, but I think invested $4 million into the country, into Samoa, Fiji and Tonga to set up high performance, try to set up academies, which didn't last long, really, because, you know, no one knew how the budget was used, where the money went. Players were still getting paid the basic salary living in the islands, you know, which is minimum wage, really. But the boys were just doing it because they were passionate about it. You know, if they had a good structure behind it and people behind it to organize and look that the money is being shared out between the union and the players and the infrastructure to develop these players from grassroots level, it would make a massive difference, to be honest. I think 2 days ago, Fiji just, you know, accepted a massive, I think it was $2 million Fijian dollars for the World Cup prep, which I think personally is way too late. Like, they have 28 days for the World Cup. You know, Fiji would have benefited with that last year for development purposes. But now, 28 days into that, it would not actually change. It doesn't really matter, really, because it's a bit too late to start investing into the team now. You know, I think it should be a different structure. I think there should be probably a 2-3 years development stages from grassroots coming in and a proper infrastructure to a governing body to see where the money is spent, really. how it's spent and if it's focused on development and the players itself.
When you consider like those things you're saying there and just how little money there is in rugby in Fiji, is it hardly a surprise then when you see the amount of like Fijian-born players playing for other countries in the world? Like only during the night, Australia named their squad for the World Cup in the 31-man squad. Three Fijian-born players in it. We're likely to have two Fijian-born players in the French squad. Severis is someone notably who has come through in New Zealand in the last year or so, Fijian-born as well. When these is it disappointing to see these kind of players playing for other nations, or is there an element of pride where you see where your fellow countrymen have kind of gone and are representing Fiji all around the world?
To be honest, back in the day, it would be like a massive disappointment because they see a Fijian cap playing for the All Blacks or the Wallabies or thing. But like you, when you've come through the system and you see how badly Fijian players are being treated by the union, you realize that you have respect for these players who's channeled their talent into different places like the All Blacks, the Australians, because of their lifestyle, their welfare, their livelihood, because at the end of the day, they are governed by a good union, and they have, they've just, people might say they're poaching players. I'd say, it's just local players wanting to earn a better lifestyle and a better living by playing for bigger nations. So I look at that as it gives me pride to see those boys excelling in those bigger teams, to be fair.
Mm-hmm. Looking back in your own days on the pitch, three World Cups you played in 2007, 11 and 15. 2007, though, obviously the highlight, that was when you beat Wales and qualified for the quarterfinals. Like an incredible achievement for Fiji. I know you were unlucky enough to have got injured earlier in the tournament and missed out on that Wales match, but like looking back at it now, just an incredible achievement for Fiji to get to the quarterfinals at that stage.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it goes back to the development. Like, the World Rugby sent in who was our coach in 2006. So you had, who is Scarlett's now, who is the newly appointed Welsh coach. You had Peter Murphy, who is our high performance manager. Then you had, Vince Kelly, who was our strength and conditioning coach. So these guys set the platform for 2007 because, they were top qualified coaches who came in and just changed the whole dynamics of how Fijian players should play, and brought in fitness tests where if you don't, no matter what, however talented you are, if you don't pass the fitness test or come in overweight the next day, you don't train with the squad, and they put in a disciplinary action. So all this pandemic kind of like changed how we performed in 2007. Wayne Pivac and them got, unfortunately, with their circumstances, they didn't manage to coach 2007. So everyone that came through that development actually excelled in 2007, similar to what Ben Ryan did with the Fiji Sevens boys. And it is what it is. So Wayne Pivac and them came in and set a platform for 2 years prior to 2007. And all the people who were playing 2007 were top quality performers because of what they did 2 years previous to that.
And looking through that team when I was this morning, like it is just tragic to look at that and think that three of the players from the 2007 squad are no longer with us. Maleli Kunavora and John Ralomo. And of course then one of the all-time great Fijians, Sarah Rabini, passing away at the age of 37. Like just incredible to think that of that team just 12 years ago, three players tragically have lost their lives.
Yeah, it is sad to see those players, they were really good friends of mine, especially Chone and Kunavori, who I grew up with, and then unfortunately, Sarah Rambeni followed, may they God bless their families and everything else. But it is the backlash of everything, the stress that rugby has behind everything else, away from your families. You're in a foreign country and you get isolated. You don't get the support that you need or that you want. And then you just, get misled by, the things that this world has to offer, like alcohol and depression starts to kick in and all these things. So, but, we cannot change what's happened, but we can actually help other players coming through the system now and just trying to, you know, protect them from all these future events. Mental awareness and you know, depression. So, and that was one of the main things, you know, some of those players faced then.
We're just about running out of time. I might just quickly ask you though, like, in terms of Fiji for this World Cup, tough pool. We've spoken about it already. Is a reasonable outcome wins against Uruguay and Georgia, and strong showings against Wales and Australia?
Yeah, you know what? Like I said, like it is apparently the pool of death. Like, you know, you cannot cut Georgia out of it. You cannot cut Fiji out of it. As you know, as much as people are predicting Wales and Australia going through, you know, anything can happen, and everyone has to be on the top of the game in order to go through the later stages, really. So, you know, I'm just, you know, as much as I'm Fijian, I hope for the best for them. But, you know, you have Georgia who could have an upset as well. You know, Uruguay could do an upset as well. You know, saying that, like, 2015 Japan, South Africa, so anything could happen. Like, I think we just have to and just play consistently for the whole 80 minutes.
Okay, Netanya Talai, thanks a million for joining us on Land of the Rising Scrum, and enjoy
my
the World
pleasure.
Cup.
The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.